From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter Dusing in Dallas, Texas, and joining me in Colorado, before we go to him, back this week, we've got Stuart Balk in Australia. Say hello, Stu.
Hello, Australia and the world.
And in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado, of course, we got Mr. John Gray. Say hello, John.
Hello.
All right, so, guys, this week we decided to take the plunge. We decided that we were going to dive in, gonna put on our pants, put on our waders, and dive into the Eli Roth remake of Death Wish. Now, with Death Wish, I guess before we talk about the remake, I guess we should mention our thoughts on these movies themselves. Yes, maybe? I mean, we've talked about them briefly in the past, but, you know, just for
the sake. We did a whole show on them, actually, man.
Yeah, we did.
I mean, we actually had the author of the only book about the Death Wish series on the show.
So. I don't think I was on that one, so.
No, you weren't.
No. Yeah.
That's why you don't remember.
Darn it. What a great host I am.
Yeah, I know. Knobhead. You're the same one that said, oh, we should do a show about Sorcerer. I already done it.
Yeah. That was way back, man, though. That was years ago.
You know what you should do? Instead of putting your fucking vinyl albums on Discogs, why don't you put the shows we've done on some sort of list and keep it handy in front of you next time?
I have a Letterboxd list, so, you know, I probably should consult that. But
it's the only reason I started posting on Letterboxd was to keep track of what I've watched.
Is it?
Well, when you're digging into the Charlie Chan series, you really don't know what you've seen before.
John?
Repeat
after me, all right?
Yeah.
I'm old!
Yeah, I mean, that's a factor.
You can't remember what you watch, man. You've got some serious issues.
You'll start watching one of the Charlie Chans with Mantan Moreland, and you'll go, oh, shit, I watched this a year ago. Check on Letterboxd. Yeah, there it is, you know. Because you're watching all those quickie B movies, you know, they tend to mind meld.
They blend together. It's like when you go through a Yakuza box set, you go, wait, which one was that I watched? You know,
people
which I advise that? Against, by the way. I'm not a fan of Yakuza paper movies.
But I guess with me, I wasn't on that show, but with me, like the original Death Wish with Charlie Bronson. Mm-hmm. Kind of a product of its time. I like the angle that he's not really getting revenge on the specific people who attacked his family. It's more just an attack on the degenerate crime in his town, really.
Yeah, it's a commentary on the society's violence, man.
Yeah, exactly. But
it's his suicidal grief.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a revenge movie at all. That's what Eric Zoliver is always insisting is like it's not a revenge movie. Everybody thinks it is and I'm like everybody confuses it with Death Wish 2. They think that's Death Wish.
Yeah, because Death Wish, with the original Death Wish, I think it's aged very poorly.
Yeah,
it has a Herbie Hancock soundtrack that just dates it really bad. But
funny thing is, I like that soundtrack by itself.
Oh yeah, it's great by itself. Yeah, but when you watch it in a movie.
I still like the first Death Wish. I'll go in there and scrap for it. I think it's a good film.
I think it's definitely a product of its time, and it's.
But seriously, how many films from the 70s really hold up to this day?
There's really not a lot. I think that one's especially 70s. But you know, but it's an interesting movie. I mean, people should go watch it for sure.
70s is the most overrated decade of Hollywood cinema ever,
by far. I mean. You know, because that generation is still alive, they've inculcated us with propaganda telling us to worship it.
Right, and I'm not saying 80s and 90s Hollywood cinema were great or anything. They weren't. They were awful, but 70s gets completely overstated for its quality.
They act like it was, you know, the second coming of, you know, the
as good as movies ever get.
Yeah, it is the best, the most creative period in Hollywood.
It's when the auteurs took over Hollywood, man, and ran the studios.
It's when the lunatics took over the asylum, bro.
They made art, auteur theory to the max, bro.
They were watching films by Truffaut and Godard. And man, you had cool cats like Arthur Penn, Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola. You had Dennis Hopper, man. You had Peter Fonda, Roger Corman. All these cats coming out and changing the form, man.
Yeah, and the irony is Corman didn't direct hardly anything in the 70s.
No.
He just
wanted to see how much cheap stuff he could churn out. But
yeah, exactly. Like New World Pictures is kind of an overrated legacy, I think.
But so Death Wish got sequels under the Canon Films banner.
Right.
And those movies are the Charles Bronson is wronged and has to go kill the people who wronged him movies. They're more traditional.
I will say Death Wish 2 is probably about the grimmest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, Death Wish 2 is too dark and sadistic for me personally.
Yeah. the rape scene is just horrific. I mean, we get it. Yeah. The act itself is disgusting and vile, but my goodness, to see it as it is was like Michael Winner going, "I'm going to make it more graphic this time." Charles Bronson just going, "Way,
yeah."
Well,
that's why he got him kicked off the series. Bronson was so offended by those rape scenes, he got Winner fired from the series, so he wouldn't work with him again.
Death Wish 3 is like a cartoon.
It's like a cartoon,
but. But
Barbera sends Death Wish 3. That's what it looks like.
It needed what's the old dog that like does the weird laugh?
Muttley.
It needed that.
Yeah. Oh, Muttley.
Yeah, it needed Muttley. Like, every time Bronson kills somebody, you hear the laugh.
No,
someone needs to actually grab some footage of Death Wish 3 when he's just blowing away people and just put Muttley's snicker in the background
It'd be hilarious.
Yeah. Don't tempt me. If I get some free time, I might just do it.
You should do it.
Well, that's like I told a friend of ours. I said you need to take all the violent scenes where Burt Reynolds kills somebody in Sharky's machine and insert his laugh over it, like Sharky's laughing.
You know what? I was talking to my mate. I said about the Death Wish films maybe a year or two back, and was saying, you know what? If you stuck Death Wish 3 and 4 with a laugh track, it wouldn't look out of place at all.
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't.
But, three.
And I remember the angry video game nerd did this thing where he talked about Death Wish 3, and he was saying it looks like a arcade game from the 80s or the 90s. And like he put like health bars for – he showed the footage with health bars for Bronson and the sheriff like running down the street, and it's perfect. It's
– oh, that movie.
But it's the canon Death Wish movies that Eli Roth is clearly a fan of.
Yeah.
And Eli Roth has made his love of canon films, you know, very known over the years. He's repeatedly said The Last American Virgin is one of his favorite movies. I remember that.
Why? I mean,
it's a terrible movie, but he loves canon films. I remember when, Electric Boogaloo came out? Golan and Globus were going to do their own canon documentary, and they got Eli Roth to be like the main guy for it. I remember seeing I don't know if it was ever finished.
Probably not. I don't think it's been released.
But I saw some of the interviews Roth did for it, and he was, you know, waxing poetic about canon movies. But he's always been a very vocal fan of canon's output, and I think that's very reflected in his Death Wish, because his Death Wish, like John's pointed out on social media, is more obsessed with the canon Death Wish sequels rather than the original.
So I wonder if Eli Roth, for this film, when he was making it, was feeding the crew Chinese takeaway. What the Golan Globus were.
Oh, yeah.
They probably fed well. Then again, it was MGM that financed this. So,
yeah, MGM puts out like a movie a year. Like,
yeah.
It's not even a studio. It's like a brand that you just pay to put on your movie.
Yeah.
They just put out films while they're waiting for Stallone to do a new Rocky one.
Well, for a while,
I feel like the new RoboCop.
MGM was just a shell for Tom Cruise James and Paula Bond. Wagner. You know, they bought it for a while, and anytime Cruise and Wagner did something, it had that label. But you know, MGM's
subliminal Scientology messages.
Yes.
Scattered throughout the films.
Exactly. But so, you know, I think we were all kind of dreading an Eli Roth death wish, but, you know, I remember the trailer dropped, and it got a lot of kind of buzz online, but I don't think that translated to box office or anything. It was just because it seemed very provocative. Bruce Willis is wearing a hoodie, sort of invoking sort of
Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, invoking Black Lives Matter stuff, but it was doing it in kind of almost a trollish type way.
Yeah, this trailer would have just came and gone if it wasn't for the SJW outrage on it. That's what.
Well, and I think Roth was actively courting it. I mean, Eli Roth is sort of played footsie with the alt-right in recent years, you know? Like, he's, I think, spoken positively of Milo and stuff like that.
Oh, if you look at Milo's posts on Facebook, you know, half the time you'll see they're, you know, liked by Eli Roth.
Yes, exactly. Like Eli Roth is a huge, I mean, over the years he's been a huge, you know, I remember he was very anti-George Bush, you know. He was very, not that the alt-right is pro-George Bush or anything, but he was very, but I wouldn't consider him a right-wing person. I would just consider him like a typical Hollywood liberal. But, you know, but he was kind of sort of getting a little, you know, I just noticed he was sort of flirting with that sort of with that political movement, because he was I think noticing that it kind of got a rise out of people, it got buzz, it got riled up. I don't know what he actually thinks, but yeah, you'd see him liking Milo's posts and stuff like
that. He needs to spend some time with James Woods, the greatest Twitter account of all time.
Yes,
James, I think he does.
James Woods and Randy Quaid are the best.
Yeah, well, it's like I've noticed that he seems to be kind of more immersed with the guys. I don't even know if it's the alt-right. It's the
It's the alt-light, let's be real.
Yeah,
I mean, the alt-right, it would not consider Milo one of their own.
Right, alt-right is now Richard Spencer. Oh, awesome.
Yeah, that's Richard Spencer. You know, yeah, it's more explicitly racist.
Or at least anti-Semitic.
Which Eli Roth would not fit into that.
He would have an issue with that, I guess.
Yeah.
So, alt-light, like Gavin McInnes and Milo. And
yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. The sort of, you know, proud
New right, really, is what it is.
Yeah, the, right. Paul Joseph Watson, you know. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed he's. I looked at his page, and we have mutual friends and like a Breitbart contributor who joined a Russian news site. So he's definitely.
Who was it? Tell me who it was.
I can't remember the guy's name. He was a writer for Breitbart that was doing like a bunch of investigations.
Lee Stranahan.
No? Yes. Yeah. Lee,
okay, I was going to say, that sounds like Lee Stranahan.
Yeah, that's a Facebook. We got a mutual Facebook friend in Lee Stranahan. So, you know, so obviously he spent some time communicating with those guys.
Now, speaking of Facebook, Anthony got banned again for 30 days.
Anthony Nesbitt breaking a record on Facebook.
Anthony, come on. He was doing so well. He was on for about 3 weeks and then disappeared again. It's like, oh no.
It's like Johnny Dangerously or something. I don't know what the hell. Keeps going into jail.
Yeah,
it goes to Facebook jail. He's been in more jails than Houdini or something.
He's a 4-time loser. Watch out! He's got nothing to lose.
He courts it though. He just totally asked for it. But
I speak to Anthony here and there, and I say, "Are you back again?" He goes, "Yeah, for now." Anthony, just calm down.
Yeah. Just you know, sometimes if you think I might get banned for this, don't say it. You know.
Well, once the Hollywood PETA stuff started bursting out, then he really took advantage of that. So he'll, if anybody wants to relate PETA to political rivals of his and stuff, he would do it right away.
Oh, God. I mean, that's the MacLeods group on Facebook. I mean, how that thing's not been shut down, I've got no idea, but yeah.
It's because nobody who would want to shut it down would go near a MacLeods group.
Yeah.
You have to admit you read the MacLeods group.
Hey?
Yeah, then they'd have to admit they read the MacLeods group. They can't handle it.
It's full on. One guy put a picture in there of just a piece of paper with scribbles all over it, and he goes, "Oh, I just got Michael J. Fox's autograph."
But so this movie, it's directed by Eli Roth. It's written by Smokin' Joe Carnahan. who many many of you may know, Joe Carnahan. He directed Narc, The Gray, the A-Team movie. Smoke and Aces.
The most hyped, empty, scriptless movies that I think I've seen in years.
I liked Narc. I liked Narc.
Joe Carnahan on Twitter, same as Joss Whedon, same as fucking what's his name?
James Gunn. Oh, wait.
James Gunn. Stupid. Who's the other stupid prick out there? What's his name?
So many of them.
Oh, fucking Knocked Up. Who's that guy?
Judd Apatow.
Yeah. Apatow. Who?
Judd Apatow.
Apatow, that's it. I blocked the prick's name.
Yeah, he's terrible.
Mind,
yeah. But Joe Carnahan wrote the script, and we've got
nine other screenwriters took a pass at the script, by the way.
Unreal.
Yeah.
You've got Bruce Willis as Paul Kersey filling in for Charles Bronson. You've got Vincent D'Onofrio playing his brother, and Elizabeth Shue playing Paul's wife. You've got Dean Norris from Breaking Bad playing the same character he played in Breaking Bad. And here's your canon connection for you. It's edited by Mark Goldblatt.
Yeah, director of The Punisher.
Yeah, director of The Punisher.
Oh, yeah.
Dead Heat. He also directed Dead Heat with Joe Piscopo.
Yeah, edited The Terminator, though. Mm-hmm. Terminator 2, I believe. He edited some top quality movies. He's actually one of the best editors you can get.
He's actually a fantastic action editor. He did, Terminator 2.
Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Yeah.
That has to be a deliberate choice by Eli Roth.
Oh, totally. Getting on
board. Mm. Yeah.
Totally.
This looks nothing like a canon film.
No, it looks nothing like it's intensely violent. But
by the way, funny note, I was in a Euro trash cinema discussion group with Mark Goldblatt, and he said when he was showing George Cosimatos the rushes of or what he edited of Rambo, George Cosimatos says, "Mark, you've made a machiste movie." So he was really proud of that because he's like a big freak for all that stuff.
He said, "The why you come to me, go see Stallone. He direct the movie, not me."
Well, we don't really know the facts on all that.
Also, Kurt Russell, he directed a Tombstone. I am dead. I cannot disavow.
I wonder who directed the Cassandra Crossing. I want to put him on the map.
But this movie,
just cut an hour out. It's shit.
Well, hold on. So one of the things that was a red flag for me in terms of knowing Eli Roth and his fetishes as a director is that Paul Kersey is a doctor in this movie. Now, I don't know what Paul Kersey is in the novel.
He's an architect.
He's an architect just like in the movie, the original movie. Right?
I think that's close, but I haven't read the book and I've only read the sequel book.
But so because he's a doctor, that means he's going to torture people.
Right.
And that's...
I think what it was it's the dichotomy that Eli Roth is trying to show, that there's a doctor who saves lives and takes them.
I think there's that too, but it also...
It also gives them the loophole to get the gun.
It also gives us scenes where he like pours brake fluid on people's nerves and stuff like that. And
yeah.
Stuff that's pretty ghoulish and, it's the kind of stuff you'd see in the Hostel movies and stuff like that.
Right. It's basically a Punisher comic book brought to life. It's not a Death Wish movie.
It's
you would call a Death Wish movie if you were looking at the original Bronson movie. Well, maybe if you're looking at the canon films, you would say, yeah, this is a Death Wish movie.
Well, so, and, like we pointed out, like Eric said, the original is about grief. It's about lashing out, right? This one is a typical revenge movie. And, another movie that I think was a big influence on this, and not in a good way, was Boondock Saints. We have to get the media reaction to everything and all the media debates. And we have, like, Mancow and all these real-life Chicago pundits coming
Mancow,
in.
Mancow, who now looks like a friggin' Mancow.
Yes.
That's it.
And the host of that, some serious satellite.
Some serious show. But, you know, the whole, and also setting it in Chicago, it kind of brings a more topical thing in, and that's that Chicago is, it's Chirac, you know, it's the most violent place in America.
And then does nothing with it.
No, there, you know, and when you look at Chicago violence, the movie does acknowledge this, that most Chicago violence is gang-related, and it's, you know, as Dean Norris's character puts it, a-holes killing a-holes, you know.
Right.
The criminals in the movie are mostly like these calculated criminals. You know, there are these, they're not the sort of, like, the only, the most Chicago-style criminal in the movie is the ice cream man. The tippy-top ice cream guy who gets blown away.
That's actually one of the highlights of the movie.
Yeah, that's one of the best scenes. That scene, I was sitting there going, whoa, I can't believe the movie did that. But, you know, that's the most original Death Wish thing in there, is just him and going killing this guy, you know.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with the vendetta he has. He just goes, oh, this dude's hurting people, I'm just going to go kill, you know. That's the Punisher, the style thing there.
The focus you put on about the media attention was one thing that really bothered me, because it was just literally like it was a 24/7 news channel about this guy, where really,
right,
if you watch something like Fox News, where it's a 30-second story and that's it.
Yeah, even if you watch local media, they don't spend that much, they don't focus that much airtime on this thing. Even if you were, and also like Chicago is such a violent city, I can't imagine that this would draw attention. And also, the thing about this, and it's, you know, this is true about Boondock Saints as well, is that this stuff always feels forced. Like, you know, Roth tries to bring memes into it, and, you know, the memes are not very good memes, you know. When your friend posts GOT spoilers, you know. All that media stuff, it always feels fake, it always feels forced, it doesn't feel natural or organic, and you know, I get what he's trying to do with it, but, you know, there's copycat Guardian 8. There's copycat killers, you know, getting killed, trying to save people. You know, it's trying to do the, we're doing a responsible take on this. We're trying to, not trying to glorify this, really.
Well, that was probably left over from the Carnahan script, which was supposedly kind of a hand-wringing, bleeding heart look at, you know, version of Death Wish, where it was going vigilante was a bad thing, I guess, kind of like the original novel. Like, and Carnahan, you know, on Twitter, he was all depressed because the movie was being released, like acting like he wanted his name off of it, but his name's on it. I mean, obviously he must have fought for it if the Writers Guild gave him sole credit, but apparently none of his dialogue is actually intact in the film.
Okay. It's,
And I don't know how different his script was, but, I mean, to me, he's not much of a writer, so I couldn't imagine it being any better.
Knock was such an overblown movie. Like,
what the hell was it with Narc getting all this praise and freaking calling it the best cop movie ever made? And then I watch it, I go, this is like watching any network TV cop show.
I will say Narc kind of grabs you really fast at the beginning, and I think the reason is, because I really liked Narc when I saw it the one time, but when it opens up, you know, it has that Friedkin-esque camera work that's exciting and intense in a way that I think you didn't see a lot of at the time. But the rest of the movie is kind of a typical cop procedural. You know, it doesn't really have anything special after that. But there, you know, there's some movies that grab you at the beginning and, you know, they're just kind of okay from there on in, but people remember that initial
Mad Max.
Yeah, Mad Max is a perfect example. The original Mad Max is a movie that has an amazing opening, and then the rest of the movie is kind of like, okay.
And after that, it sort of just flatlines for a lot of the way.
Yeah. It doesn't get good until he starts running over the toe cutter's men. So.
Yeah, to me, like, Carnahan's Narc, it has that syndrome, because I remember thinking that opening was sweet, and then, but when I think of Narc, I'm like, Narc. The rest of the movie,
Ray Liotta
being brooding, and Jason Patric kind of looking around. There's another Friedkin connection. He's the son of the Father Karras from
Exorcist.
Yeah, Exorcist. Yeah. There you go. Thank you. That
Jason Miller. But, I mean, the first time I watched this, Death Wish, I watched it because I was in absolute fucking agony because I pulled my back out. So I was literally couch-bound in the theater room for about 3 or 4 days. Couldn't move. So I just ran that projector and screen fucking ragged. And Death Wish was one of the ones on my USB. I thought, oh, I'll pop it on and watch it. And I didn't think it was too bad because I had zero expectations. I just expected
Me too. I went in just whatever. It might surprise me, maybe not.
It was like, it's 100 minutes. Okay, I can deal with that. That's not too bad. And, you know, and I really can't move much anyway, so I've got to have to deal with it. And I watched, I thought, this isn't too bad because, like I said, I expected nothing from it. However, when I watched it the second time, two nights back, I'm like, I'm just bored. I'm just so bored by this. Because all these surprises in the film, which are not many, but there are a couple, I know where they are, I know what they're going to be. So I'm looking for something else the second time around, and I can't see it. I like Elizabeth Shue, and I think she looks good. She's aged well.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You have not aged well at all.
But by the way, speaking of Elizabeth Shue, I think that the concept of a family is so alien to Hollywood that family scenes in movies always feel like complete. They just feel fake, and they feel like a. It feels like I'm watching actors in a model home or something.
Yeah,
you know,
it's true.
Oh, you know, they're eating breakfast downstairs, and it's perfectly light inside, and you know they're eating pancakes, and their kitchen is perfect, and. Yep. You know, everybody's kind of dressed the way you would expect a upper middle class family to dress, and it feels very saccharine, the family in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, they go and eat their Chicago deep dish pizza with Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah. I thought it was going to be a red herring, D'Onofrio. I thought it's going to be a twist at the end, but there wasn't.
Oh, I thought it was going to be. Yeah, they kind of set up D'Onofrio's character. I was thinking, okay, this is going to be some scheme gone wrong, and he's going to be responsible. But no, never happened.
That was in one of the early scripts.
Oh you're probably right.
It's too telegraphed anyway. It wouldn't have worked. And it's that stupid Marxist, the real criminals are the rich people.
Oh, we're going to examine Chicago crime, but it's really the upper class
white guy played by an overacting ham bone that's really manipulating the criminals. So I think they junked it at the last minute, so it's not going to work.
Good.
Wise.
Yes. Very wise move. But... that was that character there. I mean, the thing is with Bruce Willis, he feels like he's just transported from one film to another, and he's just like, just keep acting Bruce the way you were 5 movies back.
Yeah.
I was too young, but when Die Hard came out, a lot of people said, this guy, this comedic actor from Moonlight.
Moonlight was that stupid werewolf series that went one season, I think it was.
But
no, I thought that was some gay movie or something.
I remember.
Oh yeah, yeah,
but
yeah,
people,
yeah, yeah, it had a lot of gay shit in it.
But
right.
Willis was a comedic actor, and he became an action guy. You know, people sort of thought, oh, there's no way this guy. It was like Michael Keaton playing Batman or something. They were like, there's no way this is going to work. And sure enough,
or a reverse Leslie Nielsen drama.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, comedian. Yes. But the mode, Bruce Willis was very funny in Die Hard, but he sort of ended up becoming the, you know, like a lot of actors, he sort of settled into this super serious mode, and he never got it. Like, you know, Al Pacino, Jack Nicholson, Robert De Niro, they've all become parodies of themselves. Bruce Willis is
especially
no exception.
De Niro.
He's the worst, but they've
Bruce
all become
Willis became
parodies.
Aldo Ray. That's what happened. You watch an old movie with Aldo Ray, and that's Bruce Willis. That's what he became. It's like a kind of a funny, smart aleck guy who suddenly got action hero roles, started working out, started looking more like a tough guy, and then suddenly wasn't funny anymore.
Yeah.
I can tell you, for me personally, one of the most enjoyable Bruce Willis films is the one he got the most maligned for, besides Bonfire of the Vanities, was Hudson Hawk.
I really love Hudson Hawk.
Yeah, that's a movie that's kind of gained a cult following over the years.
It was highly misunderstood when it was released. Maybe the most misunderstood big studio release.
I think it's always done well on video because it's been re-released a lot.
Because it's fun. Yeah. He actually said it turned a profit. He said it did turn a profit because it had a following on home video and cable. And it's like, because it wasn't marketed as Die Hard 3, which was what the ads made it look like back in when it was released in 92 or 91 or whenever. They made it look like a serious action film. So then the crowd goes to see it and they're getting this kind of weird 60s spy spoof meets a, you know, super thief movie. It's like, no, it's just, it didn't click with them.
I want to get you guys' opinion on Die Hard 3, Die Hard with a Vengeance, because it seems to be the most... I mean, 4 and 5 are just garbage. You don't even bother. I didn't
see 5 because 4 was so offensively terrible.
I preferred 4 to 3. I hated 3.
I didn't like 3 either. I remember... I actually didn't see 3 until way... Like, for a long time, the only ones I'd seen were Die Hard 1 and 2. And I remember seeing 3 and being disappointed.
I despised it.
Just thinking it wasn't.
You didn't like the part where he's walking around Harlem with that sandwich board?
Well, at that time, that was post Pulp Fiction, and they had Sam Jackson. I think that was his first big role after Pulp Fiction was a big breakout for him. And it's just, I kind of just saw everything coming. You know, it was just like, oh, this is how they're going to use Samuel L. Jackson. By the way, the movie is actually conceived as a sequel to Rapid Fire, the Brandon Lee movie.
Really?
It was originally called Simon or something, or Simon Says.
Simon Says.
It was not a Die Hard movie. The script was turned into a Die Hard movie.
Yeah.
And they made Simon into Hans Gruber's brother.
Right. But it's like, it has all these false suspense scenes where it's like, I know they're not going to blow up, so it's not going to get me with that. And the thing is, what they're constantly going around town, and Jeremy Irons is leading them on basically a goose chase or whatever. It's like, that's the scene in Dirty Harry where Scorpio's got Harry running around the place answering phones and stuff. It's just the same. And the action at the end is so kind of non-confrontational for an action movie like this. It's just like, come on. I couldn't believe John McTiernan directed it.
I've always thought of McTiernan as a very kind of creative, innovative director, and for a film of his, it felt very...
Not after that. I was a big fan until that movie, and I was just like, I don't know if I can trust it. But I did like the, what's the Thomas Crown Affair remake he did?
Yes, that was very good, yeah.
Yeah. Do you guys like Basic?
I never saw it. I remember when it came out, I had some friends who really liked it.
It was alright. It was alright.
But he's had his legal problems, so he hasn't made a movie in a very long time, but...
No.
I remember he did that awful Rollerball remake.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. And heavily reshot. Also made by MGM.
Mm. Anyway, let's swing it back to Death Wish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
just want to bring up, I rewatched it again the other night, and then I watched the trailer. And yeah, they pulled all the best moments from the film for the trailer. There's nothing else in there that you won't see besides the trailer. It's just an empty movie. It feels... I mean, I initially said when I watched it the first time to not treat it as a Death Wish sequel or even as a remake, just treat it as a Bruce Willis film, but it's just got the tag Death Wish on it. But now it's just like another Bruce Willis film. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just... like I told you guys before we started recording, I don't know what to say about this. I'm as empty as the film is. I just got nothing.
Well, I thought it had some okay action in it. I wasn't like bored ever while watching it, but I was thinking, okay, you know, there's a lot of stuff that rings false. There's a lot of hollowness to it. I felt this way about some of Roth's recent movies. I saw that movie he did with Keanu Reeves recently. oh, what was
it? Knock or something?
Knock. Yeah, okay. Knock. That was a movie that also felt very fake. Just not as interesting as it could have been. Green Inferno also felt very fake because Green Inferno was trying to be a, you know, Italian cannibal movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it just feels like a, you know, cheap-ish independent horror movie.
Right.
You
which
know
is what it was.
yeah, exactly. And Knock Knock, you know, again, it's supposed to play on anxieties of the family.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to, I think, know what a family feels like too.
I guess he doesn't. It seems like he's a director that makes movies that just seem like he just learned everything about people from watching movies.
Well, and that's the thing. He's pals with Tarantino. He's from this generation of filmmakers that gets everything they know about movies from movies. And as we've talked about many times on this show, that does not make for a filmmaker who can tell you anything of substance, really. Because everything in Death Wish feels forced. All the media stuff, all the commentary on revenge and vigilantism, just it doesn't feel relevant. It feels fake. It feels plastic. Knock Knock felt the same way to me, where it's about it's a remake, actually. Knock Knock is also a remake. But that one plays on the anxiety of the family and the husband who has it all, who gives it up for a moment of pleasure that turns out to be a nightmare. And
right.
That also, it felt very fake in that movie. Keanu Reeves' family and his situation didn't feel real. It just, the whole thing felt very artificial.
Right.
And, you know, I think Eli Roth is trying to say, he's trying to say things with this stuff, but it doesn't, he doesn't really, he's just sort of repeating canned talking points with it rather than actually, saying anything, I guess, because, you know, it feels like Death Wish is saying all the things it's supposed to say about vigilantism,
mm-hmm.
while also indulging in the fantasy of vigilantism, which is, you know, killing bad guys in awesome ways, you know?
Right.
And that's the sort of problem I have with his films, you know? You know, he kind of got a big break with Cabin Fever,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, just a total
crap.
It was a total, I don't know, what would you say, take on the sort of Sam Raimi with the bio horror stuff.
Yeah.
And but then there were the Hostel movies, which, you know, he was trying to make a Takashi Miike film, but they just felt sadistic and strange.
Yeah.
That was terrible. Especially part two was just unwatchable.
Part two was particularly ghoulish.
Just mean-spirited. I mean, just
part two was the one that made me completely boycott new horror films.
Yeah,
because I was watching it because I ended up with somebody had to get rid of their DVD collection. They just wanted to mail them to people. And everybody else got the cool Euro import box sets and stuff, and I got the box of all the American horror films.
Oops.
And I decided I was going to watch all of them, and I watched Hostel 2, and I said, I'm done. I was halfway through it. I said, I'm done. I can't deal with American horror films anymore. It's dead.
I think we've talked, John, about how we think he probably ruined what possibly could have, maybe in some alternate universe, been a good movie, Man with the Iron Fists.
Yeah, I think he had a production rule over it. None of this kung fu stuff, just emphasized the gore and people flying around and sleaze.
I was so excited to see that movie because I was like, oh, the Riz is making a kung fu movie, y'all. You know, I was so...
Yeah.
I was,
and then 90 minutes later, I was like, where's the kung fu? There's no kung fu.
Exactly. I was going, this is not a kung fu movie. This is a weird, gory, strange... It felt like...
Iron Man 3. Where's the Iron Man?
Well, and it also felt like a Tarantino movie, like, because Tarantino, obviously, his name's on it as well, but Eli Roth was, you know, very close with Tarantino. Tarantino likes to take these genre things, but insert, like, we're going to talk about slavery in America. You know?
Right.
And that Man with the Iron Fist had all this stuff in it. It had all these themes. And it was full of sadistic gore and not kung fu. And all the kung fu in it was CGI.
I found out somebody who worked on it. He said they shot enough kung fu for two films. And none of it's in the movie. It just didn't make it into editing.
Yeah, it just...
What are your thoughts on Kill Bill, John?
I enjoyed them when I saw them in a theater. I haven't revisited them on video. I don't know what I'd think of them now. I mean, I liked them for... I didn't take them as kung fu films. I took them as movie mashups with really good performances from David Carradine and Michael Madsen.
I kind of looked at the Kill Bill movies as kind of a DJ mixtape.
Yeah, it's like a mix. It's like a mix.
You know? And there's some
it's
really...
It's like a kung fu mixed by Scheme.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like, Kill Bill Volume 1 especially has lots of cool stuff in it. Like, that, you know, fight... You got Yuen Woo-ping to choreograph those fights, and they're awesome, you know. But I think Kill Bill Volume 2 really loses it when it becomes a meditation on motherhood. And I'm sorry, but I don't...
I do not care
what Quentin Tarantino thinks of freaking motherhood. I'm sorry. That guy has nothing to say about it.
Yeah.
You know?
He's not capable at all. And that's where he could probably use a co-writer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I remember watching the featurettes on the DVDs for Kill Bill, and they acted like Tarantino choreographed the whole thing and Yuen Woo-ping was just working off his script. I was like...
Give me
a break. Come on. You don't hire Yuen Woo-ping. I mean, I'm sure Yuen Woo-ping works for cheap, but, you know, I don't imagine, you know, you get that guy just to sort of go, okay, I'm going to just follow the script, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I made him sound Italian, but there you go.
Well, I heard Sonny Chiba actually did more choreography than Yuen Woo-ping, but...
Oh, interesting.
I don't know how true it all is. I mean, because I haven't followed anything up on those movies in years. And a lot of stuff is on the cutting room floor, and supposedly that editor who would basically save his movies, you know, really saved those two films, because I guess he was completely overshooting, and everybody at the Weinstein Company was super worried, so...
Yeah. Yeah. All right, fellas, what else are we going to bring up about Death Wish? I'm spent.
Well, I brought up a lot of the stuff I wanted to bring up, which was... I thought the media angle was fake. I thought...
what does everybody think about the vigilante?
Yo, the angel, the Grim Reaper.
Before we get there, I need to ask, before you did the vigilante part, John, you worked in the media, or you did media studies, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't there be a golden rule that you wouldn't give this much coverage to somebody who is killing people, even if they are?
It wouldn't draw this much attention, but then again, when I was back in that biz, YouTube wasn't around, and their idea is the movie, or, you know, his first vigilante act was caught on YouTube, and she uploaded it hours before talking to the police.
And yeah,
so they were trying to keep a lid on it. So they kind of had that out given as like, oh, it was he's a YouTube sensation. So that's their angle on it. That's the whole fresh angle, but it doesn't really go anywhere with any of that, you know.
Yeah.
It wraps up like there's some stuff about gun laws that are so dumb, like. He's able to buy a fully automatic machine gun within like a day. You know, it's just like, for the finale, spoilers.
Yeah, we don't have guns over here, but I'm pretty sure that would not be the case.
Nah, not at all. There's no way. It'd be a waiting period, and he'd have to get a fully automatic license, because there's a difference between a fully automatic and a semi-auto, which most people, particularly journalists, don't seem to know.
Well, the thing about guns in movies is that they don't get it. You know, when journalists do pieces on guns, they're like, oh, I have PTSD now from shooting it. Oh, we need to ban them immediately.
Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you boys. You guys both shoot, right, whether you hunt or you target shoot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I shoot.
Right. Which film out there, whether past or present or whatever, has accurately depicted the use of guns as written or directed by somebody who knows their guns? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know what you're saying. My experience with guns is largely in the context of ranch life. So, You know, I can tell you the Deer Hunter is complete nonsense.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, I don't think Cimino's ever fired a firearm, at least.
No, I remember my dad watching the Deer Hunter and getting mad. So this guy brings a pistol hunting, and my dad was like, that would never... No, even the dumbest person alive would not be allowed to bring a pistol hunting. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. You know? There's restrictions. There's laws. You know.
Yeah.
But realistic firearms use in movies, I'd have to think about that.
Early, believe it or not, early Steven Seagal, he's actually holding the gun correctly. He's actually trained real tactical shooting. Like, he actually knew something about that. Early Steven Seagal, the stuff he started making in Eastern Europe.
That's because I worked for the CIA. Worked for Black Ops.
But yeah, he'd actually had some tactical pistol shooting experience, so he's holding the gun correctly. He's not holding it like Don Johnson in Miami Vice, where he's holding it like a foot ahead of him and with both hands.
Yeah.
And also the Brad Pitt Jesse James movie, Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Bob Ford. There's a great scene where they're basically two shooters, pistol men, are shooting at each other, but they're not hitting each other. They're only like a few feet away, and apparently I'm guessing it's because they were so poorly trained on pistols back in the Old West, and also the guns weren't terribly accurate, that it's just kind of has this frustrating scene where they're shooting point blank and can't hit each other. Great scene. Yeah, it's a terrific scene. Like, I loved it. I was just like, wow, that's actually probably very close to the truth.
That's a movie. I watched that, and I watched Sam Fuller's I Shot Jesse James, and both are very good. Looks it totally different looks at that that incident, because, you know, was it Assassination of Jesse James is very almost poetic in Terrence Malick style movie, you know, with its style. But the Sam Fuller one is like 80 minutes.
Right, of course.
Very. That was his first
one. That one, is that Jason Just James?
Yes, yes. What's his name?
Melbourne. Andrew Dominic.
Andrew Dominic, yeah, yeah. He also did Chopper.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's welcome the Jesse James film, because of Chopper.
And Nick Cave did the soundtrack.
And then Warner Brothers dumped it. It was like a shame to release it. It was
one of these movies they didn't know what to do with, because it was sort of an art house Western, and Westerns.
And only 3 hours long as well.
Yeah, I thought it was great, though. I remember being mesmerized by it.
I saw it on the big screen. I loved it. Like, we found a theater that was playing it, and they were showing it on their huge screen. So I guess theater manager must have loved it. And we had a blast. I thought it was better than Open Range, which I thought was the overrated new Western of the era.
Oh, I liked Open Range.
I have had the HD DVD of Assassination of Jesse James sitting on the shelf for about nearly a dozen years and never watched it. So
you've never seen it?
Now you boys have talked it up. I'm going
to
do that.
Oh, we should.
It's worth a look if you got 3 hours to kill.
That might be worth doing an episode on. I don't know. What do you think?
And then still go, I don't like it after. I didn't like it at all. But
I've got to pray my HD DVD works. I mean, my other one, Rio Bravo, shoot itself. So I gotta hope this one works. But I mean, I know the Blu-ray's out here. You can pick up and.
Oh yeah, that'd be an excuse for me to get it, because I would like to see that movie again.
Well, here's what's funny: is my wife found me the Blu-ray at a thrift store in Iowa last weekend. She just called and said, "Do you want the Blu-ray of Assassination of Jesse James? It's like $2." I was like, "Yes,
yes,
please."
And it's
DVD.
It's also way better than the overrated Long Riders, which
yes.
I was so excited to watch the Long Riders because I had heard it was this great Walter Hill Western.
Yeah,
it's a gimmick because it goes old brothers in the movie.
Oh, it is.
I liked
it
when I was a kid. That's a thing.
Boring. But I remember watching it going, this is the movie everybody says is like this Walter Hill masterpiece. This movie sucks. You know,
yeah,
I shouldn't say it sucks. It was just totally average. It was just not like, it was just kind of a subpar 70s Western.
Years, I thought it was a TV movie. For years, because it always played on CBS, like right after it was in theaters, and I thought it was made for television because it looks like it. because Walter Hill's not, he never uses widescreen.
Right.
Except for like Hard Times and
Hard Times
Geronimo.
Is great. I got the Twilight Time edition of Geronimo.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I've never seen it.
It's all right.
Someone seriously makes a lot of money at their work.
No.
Make too much money on her. You're going to get that.
I've had to pull in the belt recently, so you know, I've been going through the to watch stack.
Did you have that mindset when you bought that Devin Townsend box set?
Listen.
That's a low blow, Stu. That's a low blow. Hunter, what do you think of buying that Devin Townsend box set? Come on.
I think that, you know what, subliminally, or subconsciously, I should say, sorry, I haven't been on the last few weeks or spoken to you in nearly a month because I'm still in rehab from fucking Devin Townsend's episode.
Devin Townsend blew out Stewart's back. So.
Yeah, he really did.
He heard that scream at the end of Ocean Machine.
Addict.
Well, the only good that came out of the fucked up back for nearly a week was I got to watch a lot of documentaries and movies. And one, I must say, you need to watch. It's one called Looking for Johnny, the Johnny Thunders documentary. It's
I've heard
excellent.
About that, yeah.
Yeah. Well worth your time.
Hmm. And, I'll have to see if that's around.
But also, the other one I watched was the... I won't make this a I watched this episode. The other one I will bring up there was okay. It was okay, but I thought they blew their own trumpet for quite a bit, was the making of the Roger Corman's Fantastic Four. I mean, the crew they interview on that are making out like this was this, you know, hidden masterpiece. It's a pile of shit.
When you watch documentaries like that, there's always, this is the chance people have to talk about this thing they did. And they've always built it up in their own minds way more. Now, I'm sure it stands up just as well as the Tim Story movies, which are also terrible, but
or and the one and the one or, that came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, which has been
old.
Yeah, I was about to say Memory Hold. I was about to say that nobody remembers that exists. You know?
Yeah. It's like they were acting. I refuse to believe that anybody in the crew was that naive. I think everybody knew what was up, including Corman. Corman definitely knew.
Oh yeah, Corman. Yeah, of course.
It's like they're like they didn't know until they saw the on camera effect of Reed Richards' long arm or whatever coming out of the car. And it's like something was up. And it's like, you know, come on,
no.
You guys knew it was crap.
This movie was made for a reason.
Yeah, Roger Corman had a rep even then. He was just making straight-to-video junk. Nothing ever got released in theaters. No one was fooled. It's like, we all knew that wasn't coming out. It's like, how they play these games, it just kills me. I haven't seen that Superman one. I imagine that's even worse.
Oh. Which one?
The Superman Reborn or whatever talks about the Nick Cage Superman. That
oh, yeah. That.
I've seen it.
Yeah.
Have you seen it? Is it worth watching, or is it just more diluted shit?
If you can tolerate a lot of Kevin Smith in it.
Sorry, I can't do that. That's all.
That's a deal breaker, son.
Not 45 seconds of that slob.
Man with a you know, a baseball jersey and a backwards cap at his bar. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, and an ego the size of Apollo or something, and it's just like, good Lord, it's like you got nothing to justify it. You made a Bruce Willis movie that's so low energy, and you were given a blank check by Warner Brothers to make it.
Oh, boy. I got less than 10 minutes into that, and I cop out, and I just said, no, I'm gone.
I remember hearing Kevin Smith on his podcast talk about making Cop Out, and I knew something was wrong. This is before it came out. Because he was talking about how easy it was to make.
Yeah.
And
not a good sign.
How easy it was to shoot, and I was going, nah.
It's because he's making a low-energy bad movie.
Yeah,
it's like,
I was about to say, you're just not... This is low effort.
Yeah, you're not even trying. Because it's like, when I watch the film, it's like, why didn't you have a second unit shoot the action scenes? Because it looks like an action movie with no second unit. It's just these very, very poorly orchestrated action sequences and stuff. Yeah, I give Death Wish this. It doesn't have bad action scenes.
Oh, and then afterward... Awesome. And listen, speaking of Bruce Willis, I hear he's a pain in the ass to work with. But
oh, sure.
But... You know, he tried to act like it was all Bruce's fault. afterward. Yeah, no, it's not. He was like, oh, you know, Bruce Willis just wouldn't work with... It's like, no, dude, you know, plenty of people have made good movies, or decent movies with Bruce Willis when he was just phoning it in. You know, you know, if it's all about the content, baby. Bruce Willis just plugs in, you know?
Right.
It's just a matter of, are you willing, is your app good or not for the plug-in, you know?
Can you shoot around him and his difficulties? That's all you got to do.
And that's what a good director does.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. Actors,
Steve McQueen was difficult. Like, they were all difficult. Yeah, all like, those guys were difficult.
You know, so many actors are annoying to work with. I mean, every tell-all, you know, anything, you know, Mickey Rourke. Oh my gosh! You know that guy.
Edward
Norton's such a nightmare. You know, Marvel wouldn't put up with him. You know,
Kevin Spacey. even before the pedo stuff, he would try to take over movies. He would try to take over the director.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where a good director knows how to keep those people in check and in line, and to manipulate them. You know. How to work around it. Kevin Smith is just, he's lazy. He doesn't, you know, he expects Bruce Willis to show up and just, you know, be good, you know.
Yeah, work with my script. He also had problems with Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah, they didn't get along at all.
Yeah. So it's like he has problems with real actors.
Well, he can only work with his friends.
Yeah.
Kevin Smith only works well with his pals. That's why you'll see, you know, Brian Johnson and, you know, these Steve, Dave, whatever, you know, who are the, you know, Dante and Randall. You'll see all those guys in all of his movies because he gets along with them. But those guys aren't in any other movies because they're terrible actors. You know?
Right. It's like he can't work with employees.
Somebody asked on Facebook the other day, what's a movie that, you know, you loved that... You know, you realized had terrible acting later. I said, "Oh, Clerks, by far." You know, because when I was in high school, I loved the sort of Woody Allen for geeks angle. But later, I was like, "Oh my gosh, the acting in this movie is just abysmal."
Oh, it's atrocious. It's really bad. And it's like, yeah, I liked it in college for the same reason. And then looking at it later, I'm like, "Oh God, nobody can act in this thing."
Yeah,
I'd say Chasing Amy's probably worse.
Oh, Chasing Amy's also. Chasing Amy has
just a stupid comedy.
There are Woody Allen movies for geeks that are more vulgar and
have lesser acting.
Instead of Fellini, they talk about Star Wars and Batman.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah, this is our culture. You know,
the voice that sounds like she's on helium just.
Ugh.
Have I told the story on the show about how I was in a theater with her?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've told that story. Yeah, I heard Joey Lauren Adams and I was in Memphis and she's from Arkansas or something and she was in a theater. Sure. And I heard that voice and I went, "That's Joey Lauren Adams." I was kind of trying to low key follow her up going, "Is that her? Is that her?" And they saw me and ran off. It was definitely her. But oh, that's good. That voice is unmistakable.
Oh, Lord.
She should never try and do a prank call because she's going to fail.
There's another actress I always confused her with. It couldn't be Cameron Diaz.
Meryl Streep. No.
No, there was... I don't know. I'm sure I'll watch Dazed and Confused and probably figure out who it is. You
Jennifer
know,
Jason. That. Jennifer Jason Leigh. There you go.
I know.
I'm just kidding.
Somebody else. Somebody.
Annie Potts.
No, but yeah, she is like a bad medley of them. That would have been great if Joey Lauren Adams played his wife in Death Wish. Then it would have been totally. It would have been less saccharine. It's like,
right.
Oh God, this is like a real family.
So, all right, guys, I guess we're done with Death Wish. I mean, I think.
Well, I will say there's one scene I liked. Well, even though I found it watchable, I'm not going to low rate it. But the one weird scene that just totally, that I thought was the best scene in the movie, and it was the weirdest, made no sense at all, was after the funeral of Elizabeth Shue's character, the father-in-law is explaining to Dr. Paul Kersey about justice or the law or the police, and he just suddenly pulls over and shoots a deer. Like, what the hell?
Poachers! Poachers!
Yeah. That was the most interesting scene in the movie.
Yeah, that was totally random. I was going, wait, that scene, and it's never followed up on.
Yeah, it just, was there more there? I don't know. It's like, that was the most interesting scene, and then nothing.
I mean, at least if you're going to do that, you're going to shoot an animal. At least do, like, Wolf Creek 2, where John Jarrett's character was just killing kangaroos with his high-powered gun, and they were just literally exploding everywhere.
Well, that's what they call it. That's a weekend in Australia.
Kangaroos in Illinois to get that type of scene, though. You could have shot
raccoons. Yeah, I know, but you can use a substitute that is
raccoons,
native to that
area. Totally raccoons. Easily raccoons.
Possums.
Yeah, possums, raccoons. That would have been cool. That would have been something different, and Eli Roth would get credit for an original weird idea.
Yeah.
But that scene, was I actually liked it. He just didn't build on
it
or anything.
And I liked it because it did actually have something to say, which was, you know, hey, the law only shows up after the crime's been committed. You know, communities need to police themselves.
Right.
And I was going, whoa, that's pretty base there, son.
I think I know what websites he was reading.
Yeah.
What was the gun he shot the deer with? Was it a pistol?
No, it was like a deer rifle.
Yeah. So why was he got a rifle in the car?
You know what? It felt like he shot the deer with a lower. I don't know. Never mind.
Was it a shotgun? I can't remember.
No,
it was,
it was not a shotgun. It was
okay.
It was not a. I'm going just off of memory here, but it felt like the sort of deer rifle you'd have in a pickup truck in the country.
A 30-06. He's gonna have a 30-06 right in the truck.
But yeah. So, do we want to go ahead and rate this thing, Stuart? You probably got the lowest rating. Let's go with you first.
I'll give it like a 4. Mm.
John?
Yeah. I'll give it like a 5. It's like a canon movies worship tribute, but as a real movie, I don't give it too much credit other than the scenes I mentioned. I wouldn't say avoid it. You just got to watch some current action trash, fine, but the truth is, There's some reviewers on IMDb who say this is like the comeback of the 70s action movie. It's like,
no, actually,
that was The Nice Guys, but nobody went to see. So
yeah,
thanks.
No, The Nice Guys was way more of a 70s action movie than this. No. I'd give it a 5 as well, but I mean, I thought it passed the time just fine. I was never bored during it.
Yeah, it's a Punisher comic book.
If you're desperate for a revenge movie where people get killed in occasionally hilariously violent ways, go for it. You know, it's A-okay, but this ain't some second coming of anything. It's just a Bruce Willis action movie with some cool deaths, you know.
And it opened against Black Panther. Ooh.
Oof. Yeah. Ooh, well, there you go. That's why it,
you know. It disappeared.
Yeah.
And if you got a real urge to hear the song Back in Black by AC/DC, well, then, yeah, rent this out.
Yeah. The most overused song ever.
Oh, please. It didn't even need to be there. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Why the hell can't films just get a score, a proper score, instead of just licensing?
I don't know if anybody knows how to do it. You know, I mean, it seems like you want to score Hans Zimmer or Ennio Morricone or, you know, nobody. You know, it's just.
Why not do what Michael Winner did with Death Wish and just go hire some hip jazz? Yeah, just hire some hip jazz guy.
Well, and like, it seems like whenever scores do well, they always get somebody who doesn't typically do scores, you know?
Right. Well, I would have gotten Matthew Shipp, who's the sort of free jazz pianist. He's sort of like the. I hate to say new Herbie Hancock, but he's in that mold. But it's like they could have gotten somebody like him, gotten some of these kind of really interesting alternative jazz guys to do a score, and it would have been way more
memorable. You know what
they
should have gotten? Jimmy Page.
I'll tell you one. They should have got a new Death Wish film with a musical score by John Five.
I'm surprised they didn't go that route, you know, or Rob Zombie.
Well, yeah, because they're part of the Splat Pack, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was Bill O'Reilly.
David Lee Roth.
Bill
No. Not after that live album. He's never allowed to sing again. He's cooked.
I don't know. There's so much talent out there they could easily hire who I think would jump at the chance to do a film score.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, why not? Yeah. You know, try to do something different. No, why? You got to bring back a classic rock staple we've all heard a million times.
I remember that was the one thing the Jonah Hex movie did that I thought was kind of cool. It didn't work out, but they got Mastodon to do their score, you know.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And it, you know, it was, I have the Jonah Hex score album by Mastodon. It's all right, you know.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. How about this, Hunter? You get Death Wish with a score by Devin Townsend.
There you go.
Yeah, I have that alien character kind of narrated.
Yeah, still.
Oh my god.
Yes, Paul, you will bring me the ultimate cup of coffee.
Devin Townsend.
You feel like this voice in his head telling him who to kill next.
Paul, you will go kill the ice cream man and bring me the ultimate scoop of ice cream.
I might have to do an edit on it, Hunter. You might have to be a fan of the Devin Townsend version of Death Wish.
Devin Townsend's Death Wish.
And throw in the Muttley Snickers as well when he kills the ice cream man.
We also need Garrow's laugh in there, too.
Yeah, oh, God. Garrow's laugh. Maybe a Burt Reynolds laugh for a few scenes. And
It's like every time there's a death report in Chicago, you just hear off-screen Garrow's laugh. You just hear this voice, why couldn't it have been Obama? Okay, sorry. I wanna know if let's reimagine this Death Wish as done by Eli Roth, but as done by Karen again.
Yeah, it's the Garrow directed version of Death Wish.
Yeah.
People would have been like if it was Garrow Nagosian's Death Wish, people would have been wondering why George Zimmerman was the main character and not Paul Kersey.
Yeah. And he would have shoehorned Corn Man in there somewhere as well.
Yeah.
Rando, the cameraman, would have followed the vigilante everywhere.
Yeah.
Would have been a lot of talking to the camera, a lot of talking to the audience. Would have been some incredibly inappropriate racial slurs.
Angelina Lee's the wife, and you're like, she doesn't seem like wife material.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, she does. What the hell are you looking at?
Well, maybe, maybe the real Chicago she is.
Oh, God. Asshole.
No, I don't mean it like that. It's just like the family you're seeing with like the Elizabeth Shue and Bruce Willis. It's like it just doesn't look like a Chicago family.
Yes.
No, not living in Chicago. You wouldn't be that happy if
you're not somewhere else.
You know, like some
they live out
place.
In like Tenley Park or something.
Right, right. It's just like they don't seem like real Midwestern people.
No, not at all.
They are tanned, fit.
Yeah, they look like they live out in Beverly Hills.
California actors. That's the problem. It's the problem with a lot of movies.
They look like they belong in Brian Usna's Society.
Yeah. It's this whole it's like this perfect, you know, it's just people are different throughout the country. You know, people have different they're from different ethnicities and everything, and it's just it would just be a different looking family.
How dare you, John?
Hmm.
This is a melting pot. We're all one people. One race. I'm just kidding.
Not at all. Not at all. No, I just like I was even thinking it might have been interesting if they'd had if Paul Kersey were black, if it were Denzel Washington, it would have been different.
Oh, but then it would have been the Equalizer 3, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it's like, you know, if you'd made it realistic, like the original Death Wish film, and somewhat believable, then I think that would have been yeah, I think that could have
been. If it had been Denzel Washington, it would have been Man on Fire, too.
Yeah. That's what it Dude, Man on Fire was awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty
That was pretty fucking, it was pretty damn good.
I haven't seen the original with Scott Glenn.
Well, supposedly the novel is more brutal than either version.
Interesting. Now, yeah. I have the Kino Lorber release of the original Man on Fire. I need to watch it.
Yeah, that one looks like it was kind of destroyed in editing or something. It's great, and then it just kind of goes on and on, like there were editing issues or something.
You
should have got Mark Goldblatt in there.
Yeah.
We should have got a, Hunter, we should have got a, what is justice at the start of this day?
What is justice? What is, what if I was put on this earth to be justice?
Mm. That reminds me, I gotta get the Umbrella Entertainment release of The Punisher.
Yeah.
Ooh, getting quick because they're starting to delete that title because it's been in a couple of years. I need to get myself, but I mean, Look around on sort of the JB Hi-Fi sites and like, you may still be able to get it in. You need to get yourself, really, the umbrella release of Death Wish 2 and 3.
I've got the Blu-ray set of 2, 3, and 4.
I got the Blu-ray of Death Wish 4, but I just don't know if I could sit through 2 and 3.
I haven't seen 4 yet. I've only seen 2 and 3.
Umbrella have put 1. Various other cuts of Death Wish 2 and 3 on their disc, and 4 as well, I think.
Interesting.
Weird.
And a bunch of, they've just gone all out with the extras on there, so...
Did they get Paul Talbot to do commentary? Because he doesn't.
No, I don't think they could license Paul's commentary from the previous releases, which is the only downside of it. But I mean, it would have been interesting to get Paul's take on this one. I'm sure he's been asked to the hilt about it, but
He said he wasn't going to see it.
Oh, he wasn't going to watch it. Okay.
Yeah, he was so offended by the idea, and he hates Bruce Willis, so he wasn't going to see it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, come on! You got to see it just so you can talk about it. You know.
I'm half joking. I guessed you say, I gotcha.
You can watch William Lustig's Vigilante and probably have the same opinion.
There you go. Anything by Bill Lustig. There you go.
Maniac Cop.
Joe Spinell. Yeah. the gangster from Rocky. I want to see him as a killer.
He would have made a good Paul Kersey, Joe Spinell, if he was still alive.
And actually,
you know what? He would have made a great Paul Kersey, because he would have felt like just a regular dad, you know?
Well, he would have had a great bug-eyed, scared look every time he would be mugged or something. And would.
Actually, I'll tell you who else would have made a good Paul Kersey if he was about in his mid-50s now. Would have been Stacy Keach.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Stacy Keach, absolutely.
Yeah, you couldn't do better.
Mm.
All right, fellas. Yeah, I think it's about time to pack it in. But this was fun. This was a good streamlined episode. Glad to have Stuart back in the saddle.
Man, talking about a movie he hated.
Yeah,
getting him
absolutely.
About it. So there we go.
Yeah, but you know what? He did more than
I guess it's better than me saying, can't make it this week, can't make it this week. Yeah. Nearly pulled out tags. I've had F-all sleep. But, I mean,
we're glad to have you back. I was going to be very disappointed if you didn't make it this
week. Yeah, we were thinking, oh, no, he's going to have to get all this surgery and be the bionic Aussie. You know, friggin' all.
We can rebuild him, but we don't want to spend a lot of tax money.
Just a lot of rest, and also a big thank you to the people out there who offered me suggestions on Facebook. You know, either privately or on my post, saying, "Nah, try this," and a couple of remedies actually worked. So I was up and about within about 5 days, 5 or 6 days, and just in time for his birthday party. Thank goodness, because that was that was busy.
So the InfoWars supplements didn't help then?
No, the Super Male Vitality none of that. Just the joy of an ice pack on your back was and rest. That was all it needed.
That took you back to the spirit of your caveman ancestors.
Oh, fucking pissed.
I've never understood why anybody thinks cavemen were like invincible. It's like they're watching Ray Harryhausen movies or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Quest for fire.
Paleo. Yeah. There were no sweet potatoes in paleo times.
you're not going to endorse bone broth, John?
I've actually had bone broth. I don't get it.
I'm dubious about those InfoWars products, honestly.
No, I would question. Shit. I wouldn't buy any of them. Just go get you a bottle of Centrum Vitamins, and if you have joint issues, get some glucosamine. And
get Super Male Vitality.
I do take fish oil pills, and the science keeps going back and forth on those, but they're cheap enough where it's not really
a bad. Fish oil pills, you'll hear they're great, and then you'll hear they don't do anything and they're a scam. You know, it's.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to believe. It's hard to sort through the weeds on this stuff, fam.
Yeah.
No, I've got my concoction I take on a daily basis.
All right, guys. Good. We're health posting now. So
we're reaching now. We're talking about vitamin supplements.
Midnight Movie Cowboys health post.
Yeah. Midnight Movie Health Boys.
The Midnight Vitamin.
Take it from me. I've lost 100 pounds, y'all. I know what I'm talking about.
And yeah, inspired by our bodybuilding episode.
Yeah, that was the beginning of it.
Well, 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 well. So he says.
Yeah. That was real. Now, it took a while for me to get like the results I wanted, but it did.
Always does.
That got me to the gym, and that was step number one. So.
Mm. Right. See, we save lives. Our own. So there we go.
If we can just save one life and we've done our job right.
Yeah. And if it's our co-host, all the better.
Even better.
Yeah.
We saved Jolly Hunter's life.
Yeah. Didn't have to look
this
like Santa
will,
anymore.
We will be remembered for. We saved that laugh. You will get future episodes of the Midnight Movie Game Boys because we saved Hunter's life.
Yeah, I need to talk to Garrett about
and
that.
We got him. Got
some
him
people were going, hey, when are Garrow and Hunter going to do another video game episode? I was like, oh, crap. We haven't done one in a while. So.
Oh, yeah. It's been.
They're usually like end of the year when we're on a bit of a hiatus.
Yeah, yeah. We usually, Garrow and I have been talking. We're going to do something. So.
Yeah, do something. Give me a week off.
Yeah. I'll be.
I'll be away that week, my
video, you know. Mm-hmm. All right, everybody. Well, if that's all, I'm just going to go ahead and say adios.
I'll say that's about all. Peace out.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.